through, Sherman said, "Mr. Quigley, you are truly knowledgeable in this area, because you know what? That is exactly what I did. You didn't leave out a single step." Then he looked at Killian. "There you have it. What do you think?"
"I'll tell you what I think," Killian said slowly. "You surprised the hell out of me. I didn't think you had it in you."
"I didn't either," said Sherman. "But something's gradually dawned on me over the past few days. I'm not Sherman McCoy anymore. I'm somebody else without a proper name. I've been that other person ever since the day I was arrested. I knew something fundamental had happened that day, but I didn't know what it was at first. At first, I thought I was still Sherman McCoy, and Sherman McCoy was going through a period of very bad luck. Over the last couple of days, though, I've begun to face up to the truth. I'm somebody else. I have nothing to do with Wall Street or Park Avenue or Yale or St. Paul's or Buckley or the Lion of Dunning Spongett."
"The Lion of Dunning Spongett?" asked Killian.
"That's the way I've always thought of my father. He was a ruler, an aristocrat. And maybe he was, but I'm not related to him anymore. I'm not the person my wife married or the father my daughter knows. I'm a different human being. I exist down here now, if you won't be offended by my putting it that way."
"I'm not an exceptional client of Dershkin, Bellavita, Fishbein, and Schlossel. I'm standard issue. Every creature has its habitat, and I'm in mine right now. Reed Street and 161st Street and the Pens. If I think I'm above it, I'm only kidding myself. And I've stopped kidding myself."
"Hey, wait a minute," said Killian. "It ain't that bad yet."
"It's that bad," said Sherman. "But I swear to you, I feel better about it now. You know the way they can take a dog, a house pet, like a police dog that's been fed and pampered all its life, and train it to be a vicious watchdog?"
"I've heard of it," said Killian.
"I've seen it done," said Quigley. "I saw it done when I was on the force."
"Well, then you know the principle," said Sherman. "They don't alter that dog's personality with dog biscuits or pills. They chain it up, and they beat it, and they bait it, and they taunt it, and they beat it some more, until it turns and bares its fangs and is ready for the final fight every time it hears a sound."
"That's true," said Quigley.
"Well, in that situation, dogs are smarter than humans," said Sherman. "The dog doesn't cling to the notion that he's a fabulous house pet in some terrific dog show the way the man does. The dog gets the idea. The dog knows when it's time to turn into an animal and fight."
Chapter 31. Into the Solar Plexus. It was a sunny day this time, a balmy day in June. The air was so light it seemed pure and refreshing, even here in the Bronx. A perfect day, in short. Sherman took it badly. He took it personally. How very heartless. How could nature, fate, God, contrive such a sublime production for his hour of misery? Heartlessness on all sides. A spasm of fear reached down to the very bottom of his descending colon. He was in the back seat of a Buick with Killian. Ed Quigley was in the front seat next to the chauffeur, who had dark skin, thick, straight black hair, and fine, exquisite, almost pretty features. An Asian? They came down the ramp from the expressway, right past the bowl of Yankee Stadium, and a big sign said, "Tonight, 7 p.m., Yankees versus Kansas City." How very heartless. Tens of thousands of people would come to this place tonight anyway, to drink beer and watch a white ball hop and pop around for 2 hours, and he would be back in there, in a darkness he couldn't imagine. And it would begin. The poor fools. They didn't know what the real thing was like. Tens of thousands of them in Yankee Stadium watching a game, a mere charade of war, while he was in a war. And it would begin. The elemental physical violence. Now the Buick was going up the long hill, up 161st Street. They would be there in no time.
"It's not the same courthouse," said Killian. "It's the building up on the top of the hill, on the right."
Sherman could see an immense limestone structure.
It looked quite majestic sitting up there on the crest of the Grand Concourse in the sunlight of a perfect day, majestic and stupendously heavy. Sherman could see the driver's eyes seeking him out in the rearview mirror, and then they locked in an embarrassing contact and jumped away. Quigley, up front next to the driver, was wearing a tie and a jacket, but just barely. The jacket, a curious, meat-gun, high teal-green tweed, was riding up away from the pitted skin of his neck. He looked like the kind of fidgety hard case who is spoiling for an opportunity to peel off the jacket and tie and start fighting and cultivating hematomas, or, better still, intimidate some funk-ridden weakling who isn't ready to meet the challenge to fight. As the car ascended the hill, Sherman could see a crowd in the street near the top, out in front of the limestone building. Cars were squeezing over in order to get by. "What's going on?" he said.
"Looks like a demonstration," said Quigley.
Killian said, "Well, at least they aren't in front of your apartment house this time."
"A demonstration! Ha 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 ha!"
said the chauffeur. He had a sing-song accent and a polite and thoroughly nervous laugh.
"What it is about? Ha 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 ha!"
"It's about us," said Quigley in his dead voice.
The chauffeur looked at Quigley.
"About you? Ha 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 ha!"
"You know the gentleman who hired this car, Mr. McCoy?"
Quigley motioned with his head toward the back seat. In the mirror, the chauffeur's eyes searched and locked on again.
"Ha ha ha ha!"
Then he became quiet.
"Don't worry," said Quigley. "It's always safer in the middle of a riot than out on the edge. That's a well-known fact."
The chauffeur looked at Quigley again and said,
"Ha ha ha ha!"
Then he became very quiet, no doubt trying to figure out which to be more afraid of, the demonstrators he was approaching on the street or the hard case who was inside and merely inches away from his as-yet-unwrung neck. Then he sought out Sherman again with his eyes and locked on, and then jumped inside the cavity and flailed away, bug-eyed with panic.
"Nothing's gonna happen," Killian said to Sherman. "There'll be cops up there. They'll be ready for 'em. It's the same bunch every time, baking in that crowd. Do you think the people of the Bronx give a damn one way or the other? Don't flatter yourself. This is the same bunch doing the same weird number. It's a show. Just keep your mouth shut and look straight ahead. This time we have a surprise for them."
As the car neared Walton Avenue, Sherman could see the crowd out in the street. They were all around the base of the huge limestone building at the top of the hill. He could hear a voice coming over a microphone. People were answering the voice with a chant. Whoever was screaming over the microphone seemed to be up on the terrace of the stairway on the 161st Street side. There were camera crews with their equipment sticking up out of the sea of faces. The driver said,
"You want me to stop? Ha 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 ha!"
"Just keep moving," said Quigley. "I'll tell you when to stop."
"Ha ha ha ha!"
Killian said to Sherman. "We're going in through the side." Then to the driver, "Take the next right."
"Are the people? Ha 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 ha!"
"Just take the next right," said Quigley. "And don't worry about it."
Killian said to Sherman, "Duck down. Tie your shoe or something." The car turned onto the street that ran along the lower edge of the great limestone building. But Sherman sat up straight in his seat. It no longer mattered. When would it begin? He could see blue and orange vans with wire mesh over their windows. The crowd had spilled off the sidewalk. They were looking up toward the 161st Street side. The voice harangued them, and the chants arose from the mob on the stairs.
"Hook a left," said Killian. "Right in there. See that red cone? That's it."
The car was heading in at a 90-degree angle toward the curbing at the base of the building. Some sort of policeman was out there lifting up a day-glow rubber cone from the middle of a parking place. Quigley was holding a card up in the windshield with his left hand, apparently for the benefit of the policeman. There were four or five other policemen on the sidewalk. They wore short-sleeved white shirts and had tremendous revolvers on their hips.
"When I open a door," said Killian,
You get in between me and Ed and make tracks.
The door opened, and they scrambled out. Quigley was on Sherman's right, Killian on his left. People on the sidewalk stared at them, but didn't seem to know who they were. Three of the policemen in white shirts sidled between the crowd and Sherman, Killian, and Quigley. Killian took hold of Sherman's elbow and steered him toward a door. Quigley was carrying a heavy case. A policeman in a white shirt stood in the doorway, then stepped aside to let them through into a lobby lit by dim fluorescent bulbs. On the right was a doorway to what looked like a utility room. Sherman could make out the black and gray hulks of people slumped on benches.
"They did us a favor by having a demonstration on the steps," said Killian.
His voice was high-pitched and tense. Two officers led them toward an elevator, which another officer was holding open for them. They entered the elevator, and the officer stepped inside with them. The officer pressed the button for the ninth floor, and they began their ascent.
"Thanks, Brucey," Killian said to the officer.
"It's okay. You got Bernie to thank, though."
Killian looked at Sherman as if to say, "What did I tell you?"
On the ninth floor, outside a room marked Part 60, there was a noisy crowd in the corridor. A line of court officers was holding them back.
"Yo, there he is!"
Sherman looked straight ahead. "When does it begin?" A man jumped out in front of him, a white man, tall, with blonde hair swept back from a sharp widow's peak. He wore a navy blazer and a navy tie, and a shirt with a striped front and a stiff white collar. It was the reporter, Fallow. Sherman had last seen him when he was about to enter Central Booking. That place.
"Mr. McCoy!"
That voice.
With Killian on one side and Quigley on the other, and the court officer, Brucey, leading the way, they were like a flying wedge. They brushed the Englishman aside and went through a door. They were in the courtroom. A crowd of people to Sherman's left in the spectator seats, black faces, some white faces. In the foreground was a tall black man with a gold earring and one lobe. He rose up from his seat in a crouch and pointed a long, thin arm at Sherman and said in a loud, guttural whisper,
"That's him."
Then in a louder voice,
"Jail, no bail."
The deep voice of a woman.
"Lock him up! Yeah, that's the one. Look at him. Jail, no bail."
Now? Not yet. Killian held his elbow and whispered in his ear, "Ignore it." A falsetto croon.
"Sherman! Sherman!"
"Shut up! Sit down!"
It was the loudest voice Sherman had ever heard. At first he thought it was directed at himself. He felt terribly guilty, even though he hadn't uttered a sound.
"Any more outbursts, I clear the court. Do I make myself clear?"
Up at the judge's bench, beneath the inscription, "In God We Trust," a thin, bald, hawk-nosed man in black robes stood with his fists on top of his desk and his arms straight, as if he were a runner about to spring from the starting position. Sherman could see the white beneath the irises as the judge's blazing eyes swept the crowd before him. The demonstrators grumbled, but grew still. The judge, Myron Kavitsky, continued to stare at them with his furious gaze.
"In this courtroom, you speak when the court asks you to speak. You pass judgment on your fellow man when you are selected for a jury and the court asks you to pass judgment. You stand up and render your obiter dicta when the court asks you to stand up and render your obiter dicta. Until then, you shut up and sit down, and I am the court. Do I make myself clear? Is there anyone who disputes what I have just said and holds this court in such contempt that he would like to spend some time as a guest of the state of New York contemplating what I have just said? Do I make myself clear?"
His eyes panned the crowd from left to right and right to left and left to right again.
"All right. Now that you understand that, perhaps you can observe these proceedings as responsible members of the community. So long as you do so, you are welcome in this courtroom. And the moment you don't, you'll wish you had a stood in bed.
Do I make myself clear?
His voice rose again so suddenly into such an intensity the crowd seemed to recoil, startled at the thought that the wrath of this furious little man might descend upon them again. Kavitsky sat down and spread his arms. His robes billowed out like wings. He lowered his head. The whites still showed beneath his irises. The room was now still. Sherman, Killian, and Quigley stood near the fence, the bar, that separated the spectators' section from the court proper. Kavitsky's eyes settled on Sherman and Killian. He appeared to be angry at them, too. He breathed what seemed to be a sigh of disgust. Then he turned to the clerk of the court, who sat at a large conference table to one side. Sherman followed Kavitsky's gaze, and there, standing beside the table, he saw the assistant district attorney, Kramer. Kavitsky said to the clerk,
"Call the case."
The clerk called out,
"Indictment number 4726, the People versus Sherman McCoy. Who is representing Mr. McCoy?"
Killian stepped up to the bar and said,
"I am."
The clerk said,
"Please give your appearance."
"Thomas Killian, 86 Reed Street."
Kavitsky said,
"Mr. Kramer, you have a motion to make at this time?"
This man, Kramer, took a few steps toward the bench. He walked like a football player. He stopped, threw his head back, tensed his neck for some reason, and said,
"Your Honor, the defendant, Mr. McCoy, is currently free on $10,000 bail, an insignificant sum for a person with his particular advantages and resources in the financial community."
"Yeah, jail, no bail. Make him pay!"
Kavitsky, his head down low, glowered. The voices died down to a rumble.
"As Your Honor knows," Kramer continued, "the grand jury has now brought in an indictment against the defendant on serious charges, reckless endangerment, leaving the scene of an accident, and failure to report an accident. Now, Your Honor, inasmuch as the grand jury has already found sufficient evidence of the defendant's abandonment of his responsibilities to indict him, the people feel there also exists the substantial possibility that the defendant might ignore and abandon his bond, given the small amount of that bond."
"Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh."
"So, Your Honor," said Kramer, "the people feel it is incumbent upon the court to send a clear signal not only to the defendant but to the community that what is at issue here is in fact regarded with the utmost seriousness. At the heart of this case, Your Honor, is a young man, an exemplary young man, Mr. Henry Lamb, who has become a symbol to the people of the Bronx of both the hopes they have for their sons and daughters and the callous and deadly obstacles that they face. Your Honor is already aware of the passion with which the community is following every step of this case. Were this courtroom larger, the people of this community would be here at this moment by the hundreds, possibly the thousands, just as they are even now in the corridors and on the streets outside."
"Right on! Jail, no bail! You tell him! Kapow!"
Kavitsky brought his gavel down with a tremendous explosion.
"Quiet!"
The rumble of the crowd sank back to a low boil. His head down low, his irises floating on a sea of white, Kavitsky said,
"Get to the point, Mr. Kramer. This isn't a pep rally. It's a hearing in a court of law."
Kramer knew he was staring at all the usual signs. The irises were floating on that foaming sea. The head was down. The beak was out. It wasn't going to take much more to set Kavitsky off. On the other hand, he thought, I can't back down, can't give in. Kavitsky's attitude so far, even though it was nothing but standard Kavitsky, the usual yelling, the usual belligerent insistence on his authority, Kavitsky's attitude so far established him as an adversary of the demonstrators. The office of the district attorney of Bronx County was their friend. Abe Weiss was their friend. Larry Kramer was their friend. The people were, truly, the people. That was what he was here for. He would just have to take his chance with Kavitsky, with those furious Masada eyes that now bore down on him. His own voice sounded funny to him as he said, "I'm mindful of that, Your Honor, but I must also be mindful of the importance of this case to the people, to all the Henry Lambs, present and future, in this county and in this city."
"Tell 'em, bro! Right on. That's right."
Kramer hastened to continue, in an even louder voice, before Kavitsky detonated, "And therefore the people petition the court to increase the defendant to a significant and credible amount, to $1 million, in order to..."
"Jail, no bail! Jail, no bail! Jail, no bail!"
the demonstrators erupted into a chant.
"That's right! $1 million! Yeah!"
The voice of the crowd rose in a cheer laced with exultant laughter and then crested with a chant.
"Jail, no bail! Jail, no bail! Jail, no bail! Jail, no bail!"
Kavitsky's gavel rose a full foot above his head and Kramer flinched inwardly before it hit.
"Kabow!"
Kavitsky gave Kramer a furious glance, then leaned forward and fastened upon the crowd.
"Order in the court! Shut up! Do you doubt my word?"
His irises surfed this way and that on the furious boiling sea. The chanting stopped, and the cries lowered to a rumble. But little riffs of laughter indicated they were just waiting for the next opening.
"The court officers will..."
"Your Honor, Your Honor..."
It was McCoy's lawyer, Killian.
"What is it, Mr. Killian?"
The interruption threw the crowd off stride. They quieted down.
"Your Honor, may I approach the bench?" "All right, Mr. Killian."
Kavitsky beckoned him forward.
"Mr. Kramer?"
Kramer headed for the bench also. Now he was standing next to Killian, Killian in his fancy clothes before the bench, beneath the glowering brow of Judge Kavitsky.
"Okay, Mr. Killian," said Kavitsky. "What's up?"
"Judge," said Killian, "if I'm not mistaken, you're the supervising judge of the grand jury in this case?"
"That's correct," he said to Killian.
But then he turned his attention to Kramer.
"You hard of hearing, Mr. Kramer?"
Kramer said nothing. He didn't have to answer a question like that.
"You intoxicated by the sound of this bunch?"
Kavitsky nodded toward the spectators.
"Cheering you on?"
"No, Judge, but there's no way this case can be treated like an ordinary case."
"In this courtroom, Mr. Kramer, it's going to be treated any fucking way I say it's going to be treated. Do I make myself clear?"
"You always make yourself clear, Judge." Kavitsky eyed him, apparently trying to decide if there was any insolence in the remark.
"All right. Then you know that if you pull any more of that errant bullshit in this courtroom, you're gonna wish you never laid eyes on Mike Kavitsky."
He couldn't just take this, with Killian standing right there, and so he said, "Look, Judge, I have every right," Kavitsky broke in.
"Every right to do what? Run Abe Weiss's re-election campaign for him in my courtroom? Bullshit, Mr. Kramer. Tell him to hire a hall. Call a press conference. Tell him to go on a talk show, for Christ's sake."
Kramer was so angry, he couldn't speak. His face was flaming red. Between his teeth, he said,
"Is that all, Judge?"
Without waiting for an answer, he turned on his heels and started away.
"Mr. Kramer!"
He stopped and turned around. Glowering, Kavitsky motioned him back to the bench.
"Mr. Killian has a question, I believe. Or do you want me to listen to him by myself?"
Kramer just clenched his teeth and stared.
"All right, Mr. Killian. Go ahead."
Killian said,
"Judge, I am in possession of important evidence that bears not only upon Mr. Kramer's application concerning bail, but upon the validity of the indictment itself."
"What kind of evidence?"
"I have tapes of conversations between my client and a principal in this case that makes it appear highly likely that tainted testimony was presented to the grand jury."
What the hell was this?
Kramer broke in. Judge, this is nonsense. We have a valid indictment from the grand jury. If Mr. Killian has any quarrel,
just hold it, Mr. Kramer, said Kibitsky.
If he has any quarrel with the grand jury proceedings, he has the customary avenues.
Just hold it. Mr. Killian says he has some evidence.
Evidence? This isn't an evidentiary hearing, Judge. He can't come walking in here and dispute the grand jury process ex post facto, and you can't—
Mr. Kramer!
The sound of Kibitsky raising his voice sent a growl through the demonstrators, who were all at once rumbling again, eyes surfing on the turbulent sea.
Mr. Kramer, you know your problem. You don't fucking listen, do you? You can't fucking hear!
Judge, shut up!
The court is gonna listen to Mr. Killian's evidence.
Judge, we're gonna do this in camera.
In camera? Why? Mr. Killian says he has some tapes. First, we're gonna listen to him in camera.
Look, Judge, you don't wanna go in camera, Mr. Kramer. You afraid you're gonna miss your audience?
Seething, Kramer looked down and shook his head. Sherman was stranded back at the fence, the bar. Quigley was somewhere behind him, holding the heavy case, but mainly, they were behind him. When would it begin? He kept his eyes fixed on the three figures at the judge's bench. He didn't dare let his eyes wander. Then the voices began. They came from behind him, in menacing sing-songs.
"Your last mile, McCoy. Last supper."
Then a soft falsetto.
"Last breath."
Somewhere on either side were court officers. They were doing nothing to stop it. They're as frightened as I am. The same falsetto.
"Yo, Sherman, why you squirming?"
Squirming. Evidently the others liked that. They began piping up in falsetto too.
"Sherman! Squirming Sherman!"
Sniggers and laughter. Sherman stared at the bench, wherein seemed to reside his only hope. As if in answer to his supplication, the judge now looked toward him and said,
"Mr. McCoy, would you step up here a minute?"
A rumble and a chorus of falsettos as he started walking. As he drew near the bench, he heard the assistant district attorney Kramer say,
"I don't understand, Judge. What purpose is served by the presence of the defendant?"
The judge said, "It's his motion and his evidence. Besides, I don't want him rattling around out here." "That okay with you, Mr. Kramer?"
Kramer said nothing. He glared at the judge and then at Sherman. The judge said,
"Mr. McCoy, you're gonna come with me and Mr. Killian and Mr. Kramer into my chambers."
Then he gave three loud raps with his gavel and said to the room,
"The court will now convene with the attorney for the people and the counsel for the defense in camera. In my absence, the proper decorum will be maintained in this room. Do I make myself clear?"
The rumble of the demonstrators rose to a low, angry boil, but Kibitsky chose to ignore it and got up and descended the stairs of the dais. The clerk got up from his table to join him. Killian gave Sherman a wink, then headed back toward the spectator section. The judge, the clerk, the judge's law secretary, and Kramer headed toward a door in the paneled wall to one side of the dais. Killian returned, carrying the heavy case. He paused and motioned for Sherman to follow Kibitsky. The court officer, with a huge tube of fat rolling over his gun belt, brought up the rear. The door led into a room that belied everything that the courtroom itself and the swell term chambers had suggested to Sherman. The chambers were, in fact, a single room, a single, very sad room. It was small, dirty, bare, run-down, painted good enough for government work cream, except that the paint was missing in splotches here and there, and peeling off in miserable curls in other places. The only generous notes were the extraordinarily high ceiling and a window 8 or 9 feet high that flooded the room with light. The judge sat down at a beat-up metal desk. The clerk sat at another one. Kramer, Killian, and Sherman sat in some heavy and ancient round-backed wooden chairs, the sort known as banker's chairs. Kavitsky's law secretary and the fat court officer stood up against the wall. A tall man came in, carrying the portable stenotype machine that court stenographers use. How odd. The man was so well-dressed. He wore a Lovett tweed jacket, a white button-down shirt as flawless as Raleigh's, an ancient madder necktie, black flannel trousers, and half-brogue shoes. He looked like a Yale professor with an independent income and tenure.
"Mr. Sullivan," said Kavitsky, "you better bring your chair in here, too."
Mr. Sullivan went out, then returned with a small wooden chair, sat down, fiddled with his machine, looked at Kavitsky, and nodded. Then Kavitsky said, "Now, Mr. Killian, you state that you are in possession of information having a material and substantial bearing on the grand jury proceedings in this case."
"That's correct, Judge," said Killian.
"All right," said Kavitsky. "I want to hear what you have to say, but I must warn you, this motion better not be frivolous."
"It's not frivolous, Judge."
"Because if it is, I'm going to take a very dim view of it, as dim a view as I've ever taken of anything in my years on the bench, and that would be very dim indeed. Do I make myself clear?"
"You certainly do, Judge."
"All right. Now, you're prepared to submit your information at this time?"
"I am."
"Then go ahead." "3 days ago, Judge, I received a telephone call from Maria Ruskin, the widow of Mr. Arthur Ruskin, asking if she could talk to Mr. McCoy here. According to my best information, and according to news reports, Mrs. Ruskin has testified before the grand jury in the case," Kavitsky said to Kramer.
"Is that correct?"
Kramer said, "She gave testimony yesterday." The judge said to Killian,
"All right, go ahead."
"So I set up a meeting between Mrs. Ruskin and Mr. McCoy, and at my urging, Mr. McCoy wore a concealed recording device to this meeting in order to have a verifiable record of that conversation. The meeting was in an apartment on East 77th Street that Mrs. Ruskin apparently keeps for, private meetings, and a tape recording of that meeting was obtained. I have that tape with me, and I think the court should be aware of what's on that tape."
"Wait a minute, Judge," said Kramer. "Is he saying that his client went to see Mrs. Ruskin wired?"
"I take it that's the case," said the judge. "Is that right, Mr. Killian?"
"That's correct, Judge," said Killian.
"Well, I want to register an objection, Judge," said Kramer, "and I would like for the record to so state. This isn't the time to consider this motion, and besides that, there's no way of checking on the authenticity of this tape Mr. Killian purports to have."
"First, we're going to listen to the tape, Mr. Kramer, and see what's on it. We'll see if it warrants further consideration prima facie, and then we'll worry about the other questions. That meet with your approval?"
"No, Judge, I don't see how you can..."
The judge testily, "Play the tape, Counselor."
Killian reached into the case and took out the big tape machine and placed it on Kavitsky's desk. Then he inserted a cassette. The cassette was exceedingly small. Somehow, this secret miniature cartridge seemed as devious and sordid as the Enterprise itself.
"How many voices are on this tape?" asked Kavitsky.
"Just two, Judge," said Killian. "Mr. McCoy's and Mrs. Ruskin's."
"So it'll be clear enough to Mr. Sullivan what we are hearing?"
"It should be," said Killian.
"No, I'm sorry, Judge, I forgot. At the beginning of the tape, you're going to hear Mr. McCoy talking to the driver of the car that took him to the building where he met Mrs. Ruskin, and at the end you'll hear him talking to the driver again."
"Who is this driver?"
"He's a driver for the car service that Mr. McCoy hired. I didn't want to edit the tape in any way."
"Uh-huh. Well, go ahead and play it." Killian turned on the machine, and all you could hear at first was background noise, a low, steamy rush of sound with occasional traffic noises, including the braying horn of a fire engine. Then a half-mumbled exchange with the driver. It was all so devious, wasn't it? A wave of shame rolled over him. They would play it to the end. The stenographer would record it all, every last sniveling word, as he tried to dance away from Maria and deny the obvious, which was that he was a deceitful bastard who had come to her apartment wired up. how much of it would come through in the words alone. Enough. He was vile. Now the muffled, deceitful tape recorder broadcast the sound of the buzzer in the door of the townhouse, the click-click-click of the electric lock, and, or was it his imagination, the groan of the stairs as he trudged up. Then a door opening, and Maria's gay, unsuspecting voice,
"Boo! Scare ya?"
And the perfidious actor's casual response in a voice he scarcely recognized, "Not really. Lately I've been scared by experts." He cut a glance this way and that. The other men in the room had their heads down, staring at the floor or at the machine on the judge's desk. Then he caught the fat court officer looking straight at him. What must he be thinking? And what about the others, with their eyes averted? But of course, they didn't have to look at him, because they were already deep inside the cavity, rooting about as they pleased, all straining to hear the words of his deceitful bad acting. The long fingers of the stenographer danced about on his delicate little machine. Sherman felt a paralyzing sadness, so heavy, couldn't move. In this sad, moldering little room were seven other men, seven other organisms, hundreds of pounds of tissue and bone, breathing, pumping blood, burning calories, processing nutrients, filtering out contaminants and toxins, transmitting neural impulses. Seven warm, grisly, unpleasant animals rooting about for pay in the entirely public cavity he used to think of as his soul. Kramer was dying to look at McCoy, but decided to be cool and professional. What does a rat look like when he's listening to himself being a rat in a room full of people who know he's a rat, going wired to see his girlfriend? Unconsciously but profoundly, Kramer was relieved. Sherman McCoy, this wasp, this Wall Street aristocrat, this socialite, this Yale man, was as much a rat as any of the drug dealers he had wired up to go rat out their species. No, McCoy was more of a rat. One doper didn't expect much from another, but in these upper reaches, upon these pinnacles of propriety and moralism, up in this stratosphere ruled by the pale, thin-lipped wasp's honor, presumably, was not a word to be trifled with. Yet back to the wall, they turned rat just as quickly as any lowlife. This was a relief, because he had been troubled by what Bernie Fitzgibbon had said. Suppose the case had not, in fact, been investigated carefully enough. Maria Ruskin had corroborated Roland's story before the grand jury, but in his heart he knew he had pushed her pretty hard. He had put her in a small, tight box so fast she might have... He preferred not to finish the thought. The knowledge that McCoy was at bottom nothing but a rat with a better resume put his mind at rest. McCoy was caught in this particular mess because it was his natural milieu, the filthy nest of his defective character. Having reassured himself of the rightness of his cause, Kramer treated himself to some positive resentment of this big pseudo-aristocrat who now sat only a few feet from him, filling up the room with his rat aroma. As he listened to the two voices on the tape, the aristocratic honk of McCoy, the southern girl drawl of Maria Ruskin, it didn't take too much imagination to figure out what was going on. The pauses, the breathing, the rustling about. McCoy, the rat, had taken this gorgeous, foxy creature into his arms. And this apartment on East 77th Street where they were meeting, these people on the Upper East Side had apartments just for their pleasures, while he still searched his brain and his pockets for some place to accommodate the yearnings of Miss Shelley Thomas. The beauty and the rat talked on. There was a pause while she left the room to fix him a drink and a scraping noise as he apparently touched his hidden microphone. The rat. The voices resumed, and then she said,
"There's a lot of people like to hear this conversation."
Not even Kavitsky could resist looking up and around the room at that one, but Kramer refused to oblige him with a smile. Maria Ruskin's voice droned on. Now she was whining about her marriage. Where the hell was this tape supposed to be leading? The woman's complaints were boring. She had married an old man. What the hell did she expect? Idly, he wondered. He could see her, as if she were right here in the room. The languorous way she crossed her legs, the little smile, the way she looked at you sometimes. All at once, he was jerked alert.
A man from the Bronx District Attorney's office came around to see me today with two detectives.
Then,
a pompous little bastard.
What? He was stunned. A scalding tide rose up in his neck and face. Somehow, it was the little that wounded him most. Such a contemptuous dismissal, and him with his mighty sternocleidomastoids. He lifted his eyes to search out the faces of the others, ready to laugh defensively if anyone else happened to look up and smile at such outrageousness. But no one looked up, least of all McCoy, whom he would have gladly throttled.
He kept throwing his head back and doing something weird with his neck like this, and looking at me through these little slits for eyes. What a creep!
His face was now scarlet, aflame, boiling with anger, and worse than anger, dismay. Someone in the room made a sound that might be a cough and might be a laugh. He didn't have enough heart to investigate. Bitch, said his mind consciously, but his nervous system said, wanton destroyer of my fondest hopes. In this little room full of people, he was suffering the pangs of men whose egos lose their virginity, as happens when they overhear for the first time a beautiful woman's undiluted, full-strength opinion of their masculine selves. What came next was worse.
He made it real simple, Shaman, said the voice on the tape. He said if I would testify against you and corroborate the other witnesses, he'd give me immunity. If I didn't, then I'd be treated as an accomplice, and they'd charge me with these felonies.
And then,
he even gave me these Xeroxes of stories in the newspapers. He practically drew me a map. These were the correct stories, and these were the ones you concocted. I'm supposed to agree with the correct stories. If I say what actually happened, I go to prison.
The lying bitch. He had put her in the box, of course, but he hadn't drawn her any map, hadn't instructed her as to what to say, hadn't warned her away from the truth. He blurted out, Judge! Kavitsky held up his hand, palm outward, and the tape wound on. Sherman was startled by the assistant district attorney's voice. The judge immediately shut him up. Sherman was braced for what he knew was coming next. Maria's voice.
Just come here.
He could feel that moment all over again, that moment and that horrible wrestling match.
Shaman, what's wrong? What's wrong with your back?
But that was just the start. His own voice, his own cheap, lying voice. You don't know how much I've missed you, how much I've needed you. And Maria,
well, here I am.
Then the dreadful, telltale rustling, and he could smell her breath all over again and feel her hands on his back.
Shaman, what's this on your back?
The words filled the room in a gush of shame. He wanted to drop through the floor. He slumped back into his chair and let his chin fall onto his chest.
Shaman, what is this?
Her rising voice, his wretched denials, the thrashing about, her breathless gasps and shrieks.
And a wire, Shaman? You're hurting me! Shaman, you rotten, dishonest bastard!
Too true, Maria. Too terribly true. Kramer listened to it in a red haze of mortification. The bitch and the rat. Their tete-a-tete had degenerated into some sort of sordid rat-bitch fight. Pompous little bastard, creep, something weird with his neck. She had scorned him, humiliated him, undercut him, slandered him, opening him up to a charge of subornation to perjury. Sherman was astonished by the sound of his own desperate gulps for air, which came heaving out of the little black machine on the judge's desk. It was a mortifying sound. Pain, panic, cowardice, weakness, deceit, shame, indignity, all of those things at once, followed by an ungainly clumping. That was the sound of himself fleeing down the townhouse stairs.
Somehow he knew everyone in the room could see him running away with the tape deck and the wire between his legs. By the time the tape had petered out, Kramer had managed to crawl out from under his wounded vanity and collect his thoughts. "Judge," he said. "I don't know what," Kavitsky broke in.
"Just a second. Mr. Killian, can you rewind that tape? I want to hear the exchange between Mr. McCoy and Mrs. Ruskin concerning her testimony."
"But, Judge, we're going to listen to it again, Mr. Kramer."
They listened to it again. The words sailed by Sherman. He was still drowning in ignominy. How could he look any of them in the face? The judge said,
"All right, Mr. Killian. What conclusion are you proposing that the court should draw from this?"
"Judge," said Killian, "this woman, Mrs. Ruskin, was either instructed to give certain testimony and omit certain other testimony or suffer severe consequences, or she thought she was, which amounts to the same thing, and..."
"That's absurd," said the assistant district attorney, Kramer. He was leaning forward in his chair with a big, meaty forefinger pointed at Killian and a red, mad look on his face.
"Let him finish," said the judge.
"And furthermore," said Killian, "as we've just heard, she had ample motivation to testify falsely, not only to protect herself but to injure Mr. McCoy, whom she calls a rotten, dishonest bastard."
The rotten, dishonest bastard was mortified all over again. What could be more mortifying than the plain truth? A shouting match broke out between the assistant district attorney and Killian. What were they saying? It meant nothing in the face of the obvious, miserable truth. The judge roared,
"Shut up!"
They shut up.
"The question of subornation is not one that interests me at this time, if that's what you're worried about, Mr. Kramer. But I do think there exists the possibility of tainted testimony before the grand jury."
"That's preposterous," said Kramer. "The woman had two lawyers by her side at all times. Ask them what I said."
"If it comes to that, they'll be asked. But I'm less concerned with what you said than with what was on her mind when she testified before the grand jury. You understand, Mr. Kramer?"
"No, I don't, Judge," and
Killian broke in. "Judge, I've a second tape." Kavitsky said,
"All right. What's the nature of that tape?"
"Judge,
don't interrupt, Mr. Kramer. You'll have a chance to be heard. Go ahead, Mr. Killian. What's the nature of that tape?"
"This is a conversation with Mrs. Ruskin that Mr. McCoy informs me he recorded 22 days ago, after the first newspaper article concerning the injuries to Henry Lamb was printed."
"Where did this conversation take place?"
"Same place as the first one, Judge. Mrs. Ruskin's apartment."
"Likewise, without her knowledge?"
"That's correct."
"And what is the bearing of the tape on this hearing?"
"It gives Mrs. Ruskin's account of the incident involving Henry Lamb when she is talking candidly, of her own volition, with Mr. McCoy. It raises the question of whether or not she might have altered her honest account when she testified before the grand jury."
"Judge, this is crazy. Now we're being told the defendant lives with a wire on. We already know that he's a rat in the parlance of the street, so why should we believe..."
"Calm down, Mr. Kramer. First, we're going to listen to the tape. Then we'll evaluate it. Nothing's engraved in the record yet. Go ahead, Mr. Killian."
"Wait a minute, Mr. Killian. First, I want to swear Mr. McCoy in." When Kavitsky's eyes met his, it was all Sherman could do to hold his gaze. To his surprise, he felt terribly guilty about what he was about to do. He was about to commit perjury. Kavitsky had the clerk, Bruzielli, put him under oath, then asked him if he had made the two tapes in the way and at the times Killian had said he had. Sherman said yes, forced himself to keep looking at Kavitsky, and wondered if the lie showed up somehow on his face. The tape began.
"I knew it. I knew it at the time. We should have reported it immediately."
Sherman could barely listen to it. "I'm doing something illegal." "Yes, but in the name of the truth." "This is the subterranean path to the light. This is the actual conversation we had. Every word, every sound is truth. For this to be suppressed, that would be the greater dishonesty.
wouldn't it?
Yes, but I'm doing something illegal. Around and around it went in his mind as the tape rolled on. And Sherman McCoy, he who had now vowed to be his animal self, discovered what many had discovered before him. In well-reared girls and boys, guilt and the instinct to obey the rules are reflexes, ineradicable ghosts in the machine. Even before the Hasidic giant had lumbered down the stairs and Maria's whoops of laughter had ceased in this moldering chamber in the Bronx, the prosecutor, Kramer, was protesting furiously.
"Judge, you can't allow this. I'll give you an opportunity to speak. Cheap trick, Mr. Kramer. Influence,
Mr. Kramer!"
Kramer shut up.
"Now, Mr. Kramer," said Kavitsky, "I'm sure you know Mrs. Ruskin's voice. Do you agree that that was her voice?"
"Probably, but that's not the point. The point is, just a minute.
Assuming that to be the case, did what you just heard on that tape differ from Mrs. Ruskin's testimony before the grand jury?"
"Judge, this is preposterous. It's hard to tell what's going on that tape."
"Does it differ, Mr. Kramer?"
"It varies."
"Is varies the same as differs?"
"Judge, there's no way to tell the conditions under which this thing was made."
"Prima facie, Mr. Kramer, does it differ?"
"Prima facie, it differs. But you can't let this cheap trick..."
He swung his hand contemptuously in the direction of McCoy. "Influence your..."
"Mr. Kramer, judgment!"
Kramer could see that Kavitsky's head was gradually lowering. The white was beginning to appear below his irises. The sea was beginning to foam. But Kramer couldn't restrain himself.
"The simple fact is, the grand jury has handed down a valid indictment. You have... this hearing has no jurisdiction over..."
"Mr. Kramer, the duly completed deliberations of a grand jury..."
"Thank you for your advice and counsel, Mr. Kramer!"
Kramer froze, his mouth still open.
"Let me remind you," Kavitsky said, "that I am the presiding judge for the grand jury, and I am not enchanted by the possibility that testimony by a key witness in this case might be tainted."
Fuming, Kramer shook his head. "Nothing that these two individuals..." He flung his hand toward McCoy again.
"Say in their little love nest..."
He shook his head again, too angry to find the words to finish the sentence.
"Sometimes that's when the truth comes out, Mr. Kramer."
"The truth? Two spoiled rich people, one of them wired up like a rat. Try telling that to the people in that courtroom, Judge."
As soon as the words popped out, Kramer knew he had made a mistake, but he couldn't hold back.
"And to the thousands outside that room hanging on every word of this case, try telling them..."
He stopped. Kavitsky's irises again surfed the turbulent sea. He expected him to explode once more, but instead he did something more unnerving. He smiled. The head was down, the beak was out, the irises hydroplaned over the ocean, and he smiled.
"Thank you, Mr. Kramer. I will."
By the time Judge Kavitsky returned to the courtroom, the demonstrators were having a merry time for themselves, talking at the top of their voices, cackling, walking around, and pulling faces and otherwise showing the platoon of white-shirted court officers who was boss. They quieted down a bit when they saw Kavitsky, but as much out of curiosity as anything else, they were wound up. Sherman and Killian headed for the defendant's desk, a table out in front of the judge's bench. And the falsetto sing-song started up again.
"Sherman!"
Kramer was over by the clerk's table, talking to a tall white man in a cheap gabardine suit.
"That's the aforesaid Bernie Fitzgibbon, in whom you have no faith," said Killian.
He was grinning. Then he said, indicating Kramer, "Keep your eye on that sucker's face." Sherman stared without comprehending. Kavitsky still had not ascended to the bench. He stood about 10 feet away, talking to his secretary, the red-headed man. The noise in the spectators' section grew louder. Kavitsky walked slowly up the steps to the bench without looking in their direction. He stood at the bench with his eyes down, as if he were looking at something on the floor. All at once, kabow! The gavel. It was like a cherry bomb.
"You!"
Shut up and sit down!
The demonstrators froze for a moment, shocked by the furious volume of this little man's voice.
So you insist on testing the will of this court?
They grew silent and began to take their places.
Very well. Now, in the case of the People versus Sherman McCoy, the grand jury has returned an indictment. Pursuant to my authority to supervise the grand jury's proceedings, I am ordering that indictment dismissed in the interests of justice, without prejudice and with leave to represent by the district attorney.
Your Honor!
Kramer was on his feet, his hand in the air.
Mr. Kramer, your action will do irreparable damage not only to the people's case,
Mr. Kramer, but to the cause of the people as well.
Your Honor, in this courtroom today...
He gestured toward the spectators section and the demonstrators.
Are many members of the community so vitally affected by this case, and it ill behooves the criminal justice system of this county.
Mr. Kramer, kindly behoove me no ill behooves.
Your Honor,
Mr. Kramer, the court directs you to shut up.
Kramer looked up at Kavitsky with his mouth wide open, as if the wind had been knocked out of him.
Now... Mr. Kramer.
But Kramer had gotten his breath back.
Your Honor, I want the record to show that the court raised its voice, shouted to be precise.
Mr. Kramer, the court is going to raise
more than its voice.
What makes you think you can come before the bench waving the banner of community pressure? The law is not a creature of the few or of the many. The court is not swayed by your threats. The court is aware of your conduct before Judge Auerbach in the criminal court. You waved a petition, Mr. Kramer. You waved it in the air like a banner.
Kavitsky raised his right hand and waved it about.
You were on television, Mr. Kramer. An artist drew a picture of you brandishing your petition like Robespierre or Danton, and you were on television. You played to the mob, didn't you? And perhaps there are those in this courtroom right now who enjoyed that performance, Mr. Kramer. Well, I got news for you. Those who come into this courtroom waving banners lose their arms. Do I make myself clear?
Your Honor, I was merely...
Do I make myself clear?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Now, I am dismissing the indictment in the case of the People versus McCoy with leave to represent.
Your Honor, I must repeat, such an action would irreparably damage the people's case.
Kramer blurted the words out so that Kavitsky couldn't overpower him with his tremendous voice. Kavitsky seemed surprised by the brashness of his declaration and by his vehemence. He froze, and that gave the demonstrators just enough courage to erupt.
Yeah! No more Park Avenue justice!
One popped up out of his seat, and then another and another. The tall one with the earring was in the front row with his fist in the air.
Whitewash! He yelled. Whitewash! Kapow!
The gavel exploded again. Kavitsky stood up and put his fists on his desktop and leaned forward.
The officers will remove that man!
With that, Kavitsky's right arm shot out and pointed toward the tall demonstrator with the earring. Two court officers in short-sleeved white shirts with .38s on their hips moved toward him.
You can't remove the people, he shouted. You can't remove the people!
Yeah?
Said Kavitsky, but you will be removed.
The officers closed in on either side of the man and began pushing him toward the exit. He looked back at his confreres, but they seemed confused. They were yammering, but they didn't have the heart to take on Kavitsky en masse.
Kapow! Silence! Said Kavitsky.
As soon as the crowd was reasonably quiet, Kavitsky looked toward Fitzgibbon and Kramer.
Court is adjourned.
The spectators stood up, and their yammering now grew into an angry rumble as they headed toward the door, glowering at Kavitsky as they went. Nine court officers created a line between the spectators and the bar. Two of them had their hands resting on the handles of their revolvers. There were muffled shouts, but Sherman couldn't make them out. Killian got up and started walking toward Kavitsky. Sherman followed him. A tremendous commotion from behind. Sherman spun around. A tall black man had burst through the line of court officers. It was the one with the gold earring, the one Kavitsky had ordered out of the court. Apparently the court officers had deposited him out in the hallway, and now he had returned in a rage. He was already past the bar. He headed toward Kavitsky, his eyes blazing.
You bald-headed old pussy! You bald-headed old...